All right, so that's our class website. Let me introduce what we're doing here on the tape. So this is Bio 160, and it's September 2nd, and I think we're in the middle of the cells chapter. We're going to finish that today, maybe move on to chapter 4, metabolism. But before we get started, I want to show you this website over here, because on the website, you'll find the WAVE files that you can download the lecture in case you want to listen to the lecture again. So where would you look? You would look under Bio 160. Now there's an online 160 as well. You don't want that one. And you don't want any of these either unless you just want to... Oh, there's online 160. Here's your class. Biology 160. That's your textbook, so you should be able to recognize it pretty easily. And then over here, under lectures, right, hit lectures, and here are... that's our first lecture that we had. That's a WAVE file. You can left-click it, and it should play in whatever media player you have selected in your computer. Usually it's, Windows Media Player is pretty much a standard. Or you can right-click it and do what? Save target as. Stick it on your computer so you don't have to download it every time. And put it on your computer someplace, and you can burn it to a CD or download it to an MP3 player or whatever. Some people like to listen to these lectures again. Other people find it a complete waste of time. So it all depends. And if you play it in the car while you're driving your kids around, your kids will hate you. So that might not be a good time. Okay, they probably won't learn a thing. And then right here, this is just a text file of a lecture that is very similar to the one I gave, not exactly, so the dates will be a little bit different, but that's just there. For instance, if somebody has a hearing deficit, they can still get at that same information. And so you can look at those, but reading the way somebody speaks is very awkward. It doesn't make sense when you read it. It makes perfect sense when you listen to it, but when you read a conversation, it just sounds, it reads funny. Yeah, so I would listen to the tapes more than read them. Okay, so those are the first four lectures that we have, and I'll try to update subsequent lectures pretty quickly. All right, that's all I have online for you at the moment, but I'll have more stuff soon. All right, so does anybody have any questions on what we covered? Oh, yeah. Let's see. Well, I have a syllabus right here. Let's just see. When is our first test? Today's the 2nd, indeed, and then next time is the 4th. No test today or next time, but our first exam is scheduled for a week from today. 1 week from today. And that's going to cover chapters 1, 2, and 3. That's introduction, chemistry, and 3 is cell structure and whatever we're going to talk about today. Okay? So that gives everybody kind of a heads up. So I'm going to turn the projector off unless somebody's got a question on how to mouse around there. It's pretty easy, right, once you see how to do it. Okay? Can I turn it off? Oh, wait, okay. Yeah, I'm going to put those on Blackboard for you, a little bit different site, and I'll send you an email that it's there ready for you. Okay? Okay, so if you didn't get an email, then you got to go into WebStar, I believe, and change your email. Just check, make sure that your email's in WebStar. Yeah. The number 3s? Yeah, I have some 3s right here. I'll put them right here. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? No. Okay. All right, so we went over chapters 1 and 2. We even reviewed the end of chapter questions for 1 and 2. And those you should just be really familiar with because it's going to make taking a test fun. But if you don't work those questions at the end of the notes, I don't know how you're going to do on the test. All right, so make sure you rewrite them or something out a couple times and do the pre-lecture. No, I don't have the pre-lecture assignments for you. Okay? Just listen to the notes over again. Okay. Right, so here's sign-in sheet. I'm going to start over here with that. Okay, the cell. So we went over to organelles. What's the purpose of having organelles inside of a cell?
To
Why does a cell have organelles? Did we go over organelles last time a little bit? No? Oh, okay. Well, that's fun. Plasma membrane. That's a special kind of organelle. All right, let me get my notes up. So here's a typical kind of cell. That's on there. Let me maybe turn one of the lights down. Which one looks good? Maybe that one? All right, so here's a typical kind of cell. So we're going to learn what some of these structures are inside the cell, what kind of functions they're performing, why we would like to have these organelles inside of a cell. And I think the first one we were looking at is the plasma membrane. Plasma membrane separates the inside of the cell, which is alive, from the outside world, which is not alive. So this has got a lot of special functions, and it's got a special kind of structure. So let's talk about the structure first of the plasma membrane. Hopefully this is just a little bit of a review. The easiest way to picture a plasma membrane is that when you look at it, it looks like it has two layers. And indeed, it has two layers. These are what we call phospholipids. It's a special kind of lipid, and they just form what we call a phospholipid bilayer. And that's like a oily, have you ever seen oil on water? And the water undulates a little bit, the oil just flows nice and easy over the surface of the water. Well, a plasma membrane is very much like that. And that's because it's made up of these oils that are inside right here. So these little long legs are a very oily kind of substance. Well, that would be kind of bad if that's all it was, because as soon as you stood up, your plasma membranes would just, what, run out on the floor. So membranes have to have a little bit more structure, a little bit more rigidity compared to just oil floating on water. And there are some things that give the plasma membrane some structure, like these cholesterol molecules. Cholesterol is a lipid that can dissolve in the lipid part of the plasma membrane right here. And that gives the plasma membrane a little solidity. It helps solidify the membrane so it's not so runny. Other things can be placed inside the membrane as well. These are proteins. All right, and I guess maybe these are all the same color. Would you say blue? No, you wouldn't say blue. Purple. Oh, that's almost the same. Well, to me, it is the same. Okay, so these purple things right here are proteins. They're dissolved in the plasma membrane. Some proteins are just sticking out the extracellular side. Some go all the way through the membrane, and some are just sticking down in the intracellular side. And they can have different kinds of functions, like this one right here has a big tunnel going through it. So we call that a channel. A protein that goes completely through the membrane that has a hole in it is a channel, because it's going to allow certain things to go through the membrane and maybe exclude other things. All right, so this is a way for things to move across the membrane. Other kinds of proteins, like this one right here, just give the membrane some more structure and some more shape, because cells have certain kinds of shape. Some are flat, some are columnar. And then these, did we talk about these? Little branching chains of sugar molecules, those are what we call antigens, right? So they're little markers of who this cell belongs to, right? So every cell in your body is going to have one of these branching units, and each cell is going to be exactly the same, so that your body knows all those cells belong to you. But if another cell from somebody else gets into your body, it's going to have a different shape or a different branching pattern, and your body is going to know that it does not belong to you. And what do you think your body is going to do when it finds a cell that doesn't belong to you? It's going to reject it, right? Even though you went through a lot of trouble putting that cell in there, maybe you got a heart transplant or something, but your immune system doesn't know that that heart belongs there. It sees that heart as being foreign, and your immune system is going to try to kill it through that rejection process. And then you have to take some drugs to prevent that from happening. So that's these things, antigens. Other proteins in a membrane could be enzymes, and we're going to look at enzymes in the next chapter. They allow certain chemical reactions to take place. So proteins can be enzymes that will catalyze certain kinds of reactions. So the simplest way we can think of a plasma membrane is a phospholipid bilayer, right? But we should also know that that bilayer is very fluid, A better description of a plasma membrane is what we call the fluid mosaic model. So we know that the plasma membrane is very fluid, it can change shape, but it has a lot of other stuff associated with it. That's the mosaic part. So plasma membrane can be described with that fluid mosaic model. So this is a really nice picture of the fluid mosaic model. The fluidity of the membrane plus all of these other different components that can be added to the plasma membrane. All right, so this cell right here has got other things besides the cell membrane. This is very similar to some of the cells in our body. This cell right here is what we call a generalized cell. It has almost every conceivable organelle that a human cell can have, and it's all been put together. But you might not have a cell in your body that has all of these, but if we look at all the cells in your body, it's going to contain all these different organelles. So we just put it all in one cell to show you what everything looks like. All right, so here's that plasma membrane. There can be things that stick out of the plasma membrane, like here and here and here. So these are projections coming out of the cell, and they can have different functions. This one right here is what we call a flagellum, and it's a little short on this diagram. It might be about maybe 10 times longer than this. There are things called microtubules on the inside of it, and they can slide past each other, and it's going to make this flagellum whip around. And there's only one kind of cell in the body that has a flagellum. Anybody know what that is? And that is a sperm cell. That's right, a sperm has a flagellum, and when it whips around, guess what that flagellum, what the sperm does? It swims around all over the place. Sounds like my phone. Isn't that my phone? Good. I don't know if I turned mine off or not. All right, so this flagellum is real important because if you're just going to think of one key term, which you should write on your piece of paper, what a flagellum does is that it gives this cell motility. Right? Motility. Which means what? It can swim around. So that sperm can swim around anywhere. Motility. Motility. M-O-T-I-L-I-T-Y. Motility. Means it's motile. It can motor around with that flagellum. There's some other smaller projections over here that we call cilia. See cilia right here that come off the cell? These are also important for motility. Human cells don't swim around when the cilia sweep, but the cilia are all going to be sweeping in the same direction on the cell and the neighboring cells. So if there is some kind of fluid next to the cell, it's going to do what? It's going to move the fluid along the surface of the cell because the cell is going to be anchored someplace with neighbors on either side. So again, cilia are important for motility, but for moving fluid over the surface of the cell. And we're going to see where that's real important. Maybe I'll give you a quick example. In our airways, it's called a trachea that leads from our larynx to our lungs. It's lined with cells that have cilia. So the cilia are sweeping all the time because as we breathe in, dust particles attach to our trachea. That's one of the functions of our trachea is to grab hold of junk before it gets into our lungs. And which way do you think the cilia are beating? Are they beating the junk so it goes up? Or are they beating so the junk goes down? Okay, I like your word. Okay, you said out. Out means up. Right, because your lungs are a dead-end sac, and if it gets filled up with dust, then you wouldn't be able to breathe. So the cilia are sweeping dust particles that get trapped by the lining of your trachea, and they sweep it up into your mouth. And when it's in your mouth, what's done then with all that garbage that was in your trachea? You just swallow it down into your stomach and get rid of it that way. All right? Unless you're what? Unless you're what? Unless you're a baseball player, then you spit it out all the time. Okay. Okay. So the important function of cilia is what? Motility again. Motility. And then these little projections right here, these don't have anything to do with motility. These are what we call microvilli. These increase absorption of certain cells that line your digestive tract. You want to absorb food and nutrients, and these microvilli allow that to happen. Okay, so that's some important things. What else do we have? Okay, let's look at this area of the cell right up over here. We see a bunch of membranes, stacks of membranes right here, and maybe some over in this region as well. And you can see some little dots all over these membranes. This part of the cell is what we call rough endoplasmic reticulum. So most places where you see membranes lined up upon membranes, that's endoplasmic reticulum. But when it has those dots all over it, we call it rough. It kind of looks like sandpaper, right? So that's like sandpaper, and there's sandpaper over here. Rough endoplasmic reticulum. And if you're going to describe what the function of rough endoplasmic reticulum is, here's a nice shot. This is rough endoplasmic reticulum. You're going to say protein synthesis. Protein synthesis takes place on rough ER. All right, so RER stands for rough endoplasmic reticulum. What's the function of this guy right here? Who can tell? Yeah, protein synthesis, right? Okay. If we look at another kind of endoplasmic reticulum, like what we see right here, all these tubes of membranes, where do we see that in the cell? Like in this area right here? You can't call that rough endoplasmic reticulum because it doesn't have all these dots, which are ribosomes dotted all over it, so we call that smooth ER, smooth endoplasmic reticulum. It's got a different function. Smooth endoplasmic reticulum is important for lipid synthesis. And we're kind of familiar with couple kinds of lipids already, and that is the phospholipid that all the membranes are made out of, come from this guy right here. Cholesterol is used, right, to make other kinds of hormones in smooth ER. So that's a pretty important organelle. So this sort of looks like this, the rough ER sort of looks like smooth ER, except the rough ER has got these dots all over the place. These dots are what we call ribosomes. They're really small. And a ribosome is the site for protein synthesis. That's like the workbench that proteins are put together. And does anybody know what the basic building block of a protein is? What's a protein made out of? Probably some of you have heard, maybe before you would take a class like this, what the building block of a protein is. It's called an amino acid. Amino acid. So protein might be 8 amino acids put together, might even be as many as 1,000 amino acids put together. And where amino acids are put together are on these little dots right here that we call, what are these dots again called? Ribosomes, right? So that's why rough ER is for protein synthesis. And why can't the smooth endoplasmic reticulum make proteins? It's got no ribosomes. Right, so it doesn't have that capability to do that. Okay, so that I'll put over here. Where's something else that kind of looks similar? Oh, it's nice because it's given a little bit different color. Is it purple?
Yeah.
Good, okay. This right here, notice it doesn't have any ribosomes on it, so it can't make proteins. And notice how instead of curving around the center structure that we call the nucleus, it kind of bends the opposite way. Okay, it's more like pointing out to the cell membrane. This is what we call the Golgi apparatus. It goes by another name, sometimes called Golgi body. And it starts with that capital G because it's named after somebody that first described it or found it. And so let's zoom into what it looks like right over here. All right, so here you see endoplasmic reticulum. Does it look rough or smooth to you? Oh, but what about that dot right there? Kind of hard to see. Maybe if I move it more in the center, I get a little bit better. See the little dot there. So what's the job of this guy right here? Because it has ribosomes. Protein synthesis. So it's making some kind of proteins. And the proteins are inside the membrane. They're not floating around in the cytosol. They're inside the membrane. And a little vesicle will break off from this one, and it will move over to this part of the cell, and it will fuse with this membrane over here. This is a Golgi apparatus. So now the Golgi apparatus has that protein that was made by the rough endoplasmic reticulum, and it moves through the membrane system over here, and it might be modified. That protein might have a sugar molecule added to it, so it can become an antigen in the cell membrane. Or maybe it will have a fat glued onto it. We call that conjugation. And so in this Golgi apparatus right here, the contents that come from the rough ER get modified. So that's one important function of Golgi body, is that it modifies proteins, for instance. And as things are modified, they end up over on the plasma membrane or the cell membrane side of the Golgi body. And so what the Golgi body then does is take these products that have been modified and it puts it into a vesicle. And you can see this vesicle pinching off of the Golgi body right here. And this vesicle, here it is, moves over to the plasma membrane and it can fuse to the plasma membrane. And when it fuses to the plasma membrane, whatever was inside the vesicle gets spit outside the cell. And so we call this a secretory pathway. So this vesicle is just a little transport vesicle that's moving things from the Golgi apparatus to the outside of the cell. This process of secreting is what we call exocytosis. Exo means leaving, exocytosis the cell, and tosis is a process. So this is a process by which things can leave the cell, like maybe hormones that are secreted, or even mucus, for instance. So this is a nice secretory pathway. So if I think of just the key words for Golgi body, I would say, number one, modification, and number two, packaging into these vesicles so that, whatever is being produced or modified, that product is what? Secreted outside the cell. So modification and packaging for secretion. So on the test, you know, I might have a picture of this cell where you should be able to label these different organelles inside the cell. But this, now don't forget, the test is just going to be photocopied in black and white. So if you learn these organelles by the color, you're going to be at a big disadvantage. Learn these organelles by what? Their shape and their structure and whether they have dots on them or not, right? Just don't say, okay, everything was yellow. Don't get on the phone and say, oh, what's a yellow organelle? Because that won't be on the test, right? Because I won't photocopy it in color. Another organelle right over here. This is what we call a mitochondria. Mitochondria is kind of bean-shaped, and it might actually kind of look like a kidney bean in some circumstances, but it's longer than it is wide. It has membranes in it as well. These inner membranes are what we call Christi, and the function of mitochondria is to make ATP. And we're going to look at ATP. ATP is the chemical that runs our cells. That's the energy source for our cells. So in your car, what's the energy source in your car? Yeah, battery. That's, but you can't like drive to school on your battery probably. It would drain down. What would be? Gasoline. Unless you have a really nice car that is all battery. There are cars that are just batteries now. Okay. Fuel cell. Okay. Hydrogen fuel cell. But anyway, gasoline is the traditional kind of energy that we use in our cars to drive around. The cell can't use gasoline. It has to use a molecule called ATP. And so mitochondria, this guy right here, the job of him is to make plenty of ATP so that our cells can stay alive. Yeah.
You didn't tell the story about your car. I didn't use gasoline.
Oh, yeah, maybe in the next chapter I will. Okay. All right, so here you can see this is a mitochondria because it has these folds of additional membranes inside the mitochondria are what we call Christi. So this is an illustration, but this picture over here is a really nice electron microscope picture of what the inside of a mitochondria looks like. You can see lots of different folds. So we call this an electron micrograph. A micrograph is a picture that we take through a microscope. So it's very high magnification. Plus, over here, I see something that we've described already. Layers and layers of membranes with these dots on them. What are layers and layers and layers of membranes with these dots on? What's that called? Rough ER. And the dots represent, or are, ribosomes. And what's happening on those ribosomes? Making proteins. So this is a pretty fascinating picture, actually. Okay. So let's get back to this mitochondria right here. The way that it makes ATP is that it needs oxygen. So how do we get oxygen in our bodies? By breathing, by inhaling. And then oxygen is going to be picked up by our circulatory system, carried all over our body, so that these mitochondria don't run out of oxygen. Because if they do, they can't make ATP, the energy source for keeping you alive. So let's just say, or let's get a feel for how much ATP your body needs at any particular time. So for instance, if somebody has a heart attack and their heart stops beating all of a sudden, eventually they're going to pass out because their brain runs out of ATP. When will they lose consciousness because oxygen isn't being delivered to their brain? Mitochondria aren't getting oxygen. Mitochondria can't make ATP. But the brain is still active. It's using up all the ATP, just like in your car. When you run out of gasoline, the car stops. Right? When your brain runs out of ATP, it stops. And when it stops, you lose consciousness. You pass out. How long do you have before this mitochondria here can't make ATP and all the ATP is used up in your brain and you pass out? After your heart stops, how long do you have? When does your brain lose consciousness? It's a matter of seconds. It's about 3 seconds. Not very long. So that's how much ATP your brain has to have all the time, all right, before it loses function, before it runs out of gasoline. 3 seconds. That's not a lot of time, is it? That's hardly any time at all. All right, so your brain is still alive. It's just not functioning. Like you could start your car up again. But there's a period of time when, if your brain doesn't have ATP, guess what's going to happen to it? It's really going to die. And when something's dead, what does that mean? You can't ever get it started again, right? When something's dead, you can't bring it back to life. So after somebody's heart stops beating, after 3 seconds, they become unconscious. After what period of time can't we ever revive them again because they're brain dead? How much time do we have? Okay, 3 seconds before you go unconscious, 3 minutes before the brain dies. Not very much time at all, right? So that's why when somebody has a heart attack, their heart stops, it's really a good idea that somebody's around that knows what? Is educated in CPR, because they can breathe for somebody that's not breathing. They can do some chest compressions, and that beats their heart even though their heart isn't beating, and that delivers a little bit of oxygen to their brain. Hopefully enough to where that person can get to the hospital and they can start their heart up again beating normally. All right, so that's the job of this guy. Pretty important sounding? Yeah. 3 seconds and these guys can't do their job without oxygen. That's a pretty big deal. All right, what's another organelle? So here are mitochondria. We talked about the rough ER, the smooth ER, the Golgi, flagellum, cilia, microvilli. What am I missing? Oh, these guys over here. All right, but before I talk about the centrioles, I want to talk a little bit about these microtubules that I see inside this flagellum right here and in the cilia. And look, even inside the cell, I see microtubules inside the cell. So there are microtubules. Microtubules act like the skeletons do in your body. It gives the cell a particular shape because it can attach to the cell membrane. Some cells are kind of round. Others are going to be square because the microtubules force that plasma membrane into a certain kind of shape. As a matter of fact, some cells can even change their shape. They can crawl around inside your body just by squeezing between cells. And that's because these microtubules can change the shape of the cell. The other thing that these microtubules can do is that when an organelle, for instance, like this vesicle right here, is attached to a microtubule, it can hop a ride on that microtubule to a different part of the cell, like from the Golgi body over to the cell membrane. So it acts like a train track. But what do we call a train track that only has one track on it instead of two? What's like a Greek word for one? Mono. Okay, so what's a train that only has one track? It's called a monorail. So these microtubules inside the cell act like little monorails in the cell so it can position all of these organelles or maybe even move them around inside the cell. All right, so that's a nice way of thinking of these microtubules as a little monorail system inside the cell for moving things around. And the thing that coordinates all of these microtubules are the centrioles. The centrioles act as like the grand central station for these microtubules. It anchors all of the microtubules inside the cell, plus it probably gives directions on what those microtubules should be doing, what should they be attaching to. So centrioles are pretty important for coordinating the microtubules, which do what? Coordinate everything inside the cell in terms of position and even cell shape. So we see these centrioles right there. All right, so we talked about a number of different kinds of organelles inside the cell, and they look different by their shape, but how else are they different by?
Organelles.
Yeah, organelles. They're different because they look different, they have a different shape, but they're also different because why?
Function.
They have a different function. That's right. So this kind of class is what, an anatomy and physiology class. So if I ask you, what is this thing right here? By its shape, you're going to say it's a centriole. Is that anatomy or is that physiology? That's anatomy. But if I say, what's the function of these centrioles right here? And you say, well, it controls the microtubules inside the cell. Is that anatomy or physiology?
Physiology.
Physiology. Right? So when we look at something, in even these organelles right here, there is a structural functional relationship between them. They have a certain structure which allows them to perform a certain kind of function. So that's both anatomy and physiology. Okay. So what else? Ah, other kinds of vesicles inside the cell. Let me see if I can find one. Here I see a secretory vesicle coming from this Golgi body over to the cell membrane. There are other things called lysozymes. Here. Here's a lysosome. Here's a lysosome. Okay, lysosome. Now, is that the same color as a secretory vesicle? Hopefully a little bit different. Light blue. Dark purple. Okay, let's just say. All right, and inside these vesicles right here, there are digestive enzymes. And those digestive enzymes are made by the rough endoplasmic reticulum. And what does a digestive enzyme do? It breaks down larger molecules, right? It will digest something. So these lysosomes are an intracellular, that means inside the cell, digestive system. It can digest things that are inside the cell. Maybe a bacteria that's trying to infect the cell, finds its way in, breaks into the cell, but then it bumps into a lysosome or the cell realizes that it's in there and it moves the lysosome over. And the lysosome forms around the bacteria, and the bacteria is inside this lysosome, what's going to happen to it? It's going to be digested, broken down into its building blocks, and when it's broken down, it is dead and can't cause an infection, right? It's gone. So this is one way that the cell can protect itself from infection, but it can also break down larger molecules into smaller ones so that it can, those little pieces can be used again to make other things that the cell needs.
Does it
save
it?
You know, it might save it, or it might actually bring it over to the endoplasmic reticulum, yeah, or it might export it into the cytoplasm. And I wouldn't be surprised maybe sometimes if it brings it over to the cell membrane and just spits it outside the cell. So it all depends on what this guy right here says. And what I'm pointing at right here is the nucleus. Right, that controls, that's the master control organelle inside the cell. It controls all of the cell's activities. All right, well, I want to get back to the lysosome for just a second to give you a feel for how important it is to know all of these different organelles inside the cell. For instance, if somebody's heart is not getting, or brain is not getting oxygen, okay, then mitochondria can't make ATP. For instance, if they have heart failure or heart disease or something like that, some kind of acute heart condition, These membranes are maintained by ATP. And when ATP goes away, then all of the membranes of this cell start to leak. And when this lysosome starts to leak, guess what it leaks inside the cell, inside into the cytoplasm? What's inside? Yeah, what's inside this lysosome right here? Digestive enzymes. So now you have digestive enzymes running around inside the cell, and guess what those enzymes do? They start to digest your cells from the inside out. Okay, because we figured out what was going on inside a lysosome. So now when people have strokes and heart attacks and things like that, they're given drugs specifically to keep these lysosomes happy and healthy so they're not so leaky. And those are what we call corticosteroids. So they're given a little bit of corticosteroid, even though it really doesn't have anything to do with their heart attack. It does what? It protects all of these membranes, especially those lysosomes, so they don't start leaking digestive enzymes out into the cell and killing the cell from the inside. So it's real important to know the functions of all of these different things. All right, here we see that nice microtubule system inside the cell. You can see some little ribosomes right here and a nice mitochondria in the rough endoplasmic reticulum. So again, this just shows you the cytoskeleton, the skeleton inside the cell that will give the cell its shape. And the cytoskeleton can even, move some of these organelles around inside the cell. This is just a nice, large, blown-up picture of a upside-down and backwards centriole. Okay, this is a nice electron micrograph. These are the things that control the microtubules inside the cell. And you can see they're made out of what? Microtubules. Right, so it's interesting that these things control the microtubules, and that's these guys right here. That's the small picture of it. Here's a picture of cilia. These are the short little processes coming off of a cell that whip around. What's the function of a cilium again? It is, in the fancy scientific term, we would say motility. They're moving things around. What's another organelle on a cell that's important for motility? Flagellum. You see them right there? On this not very active bunch, but they would be whipping around like crazy. Okay, so we were just about to talk about this thing right here, the master control organelle inside the cell. And this is the nucleus. The nucleus contains chromosomes, which are made out of DNA. And chromosomes are the blueprint on how to put your body together. Just like when you build a building, you got to have a blueprint of it so you know where the walls go, where the electrical wires go, plumbing goes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's what's contained inside this nucleus right here. It's the blueprint for how to put this cell together. But it's more than that too, right? Because along with structure, what else comes along with structure inside the cell? The function. So the nucleus not only tells the cell how it should be built, but also how it should be functioned. How it should function. Okay? So the chromosomes determine both the structure and the function of the cell. That's very important information. Because if that information gets lost, what happens to the function of the cell? It goes haywire or stops, and then the life of the cell is gone, right? Once it's dead, you can't get the cell back. So that's the importance of these chromosomes right here. And the very center, you can see, looks a little bit darker than some of the perimeter of the nucleus. This dark spot right here is what we call the nucleolus. And the nucleolus is the active part of the nucleus. Let me show you. All right, so here is a nice blown up picture of a nucleus. Here's a micrograph, electron micrograph of a nucleus. And you can see a dark spot right here. This dark spot, or the nucleolus, is the active part of the nucleus. And that's the part that is making a chemical compound we call RNA. So DNA makes chromosomes that are inside the nucleus. RNA copies that information. And RNA can leave the nucleus and it can direct how proteins are made in the cytoplasm. So, for instance, if something happens to the DNA inside the cell, what happens to the cell? What happens to the cell if this DNA is destroyed or disrupted somehow? What happens to the cell? Yeah, the cell dies. The cell dies. Okay. But under normal living conditions, DNA is used to make RNA. That RNA then leaves the nucleus and goes into the cytoplasm, where it directs the living processes inside the cytoplasm. What happens if that RNA gets destroyed when it's in the cytoplasm? Does that necessarily mean the death of the cell?
No.
No. And the reason why is, why? Because the nucleus will figure that out eventually and it will say, oh, well, I got a copy of that information in DNA. I'll just make more RNA and put it into the cytoplasm. So it's okay if this RNA gets damaged or destroyed. Not a big deal for the cell because it can always make more from DNA. But if that DNA gets lost, that information isn't around anywhere. Right. So that's really the purpose of the nucleus right here. Because it's protecting what? It's protecting the DNA from being corrupted. You might have a computer at home that there's a program that you like to use all the time, like Microsoft Word or something, and all of a sudden that program starts acting weird. What do? You can delete it from your computer and hopefully reload the software. But in the cell right here, if that program, the DNA gets destroyed, you can't reload that DNA. It's dead. Right? You would need a new computer or something. That doesn't happen. But the RNA can be replaced by information that's in DNA. And where's that DNA made? Inside the nucleus. Where's most of the RNA made? Inside the nucleus. You can see it on the picture. It's what part of the nucleus? It's this dark area right here. It's the nucleolus. The nucleolus is the active part of the nucleus that's making RNA. Right here. That's the nucleolus. All right, so that's a function of the nucleus. Pretty important. We don't ever want to lose this information in DNA, and if it gets damaged, that could produce a cancer. All right, then that cell goes nuts and starts to outgrow your whole body. All right, so let's look at an overall picture. Why do we have all of these different organelles inside our cells? It seems a little complicated. I mean, it's nice that we broke it down and we know that mitochondria make ATP. Golgi is for modification and packaging. Smoothie R is for making lipids. Right? But why do we have all these different organelles inside the cell? Why not just do all of that inside the cell without organelles? So I guess maybe a good hint would be to think of this building right here. What does this building have? Is it just one big empty shell with one big auditorium? Or what is it? What does this building have? Many different rooms. And what's the function of all the different rooms inside this building? Yeah, to separate the different functions out. Right? If it was just one big room, then we would have the anatomy lecture here and a physics lecture in the same room. And what else is over here? Chemistry lecture. No one would come to class if it was all in one room with chemistry lectures. What else? Math. All right. Maybe five or six math lectures at one time. So if we had thousands of students in one big room and five or six lecture instructors all lecturing at the same time, what would it be? Who would be learning anything? Nobody. It would just be mass confusion, right? So the reason why there are rooms in a building is so that different functions can take place in the same building at the same time without interference. That's an important thing. And so a cell has different organelles so that ATP production, protein synthesis, lipid synthesis, modification and packaging for secretion can all take place at the same time without interference with each other. So that's why cells have organelles. So it's a very complicated business, but it's separated out so that these functions don't interfere with each other. Who's got a question on that? Okay, so I think that's important to see that. All right, so let me just look over the list. We did that one, that one, that one, that one, that one. That one, that one, that one, that one, that. We did them all. Okay, so what is cytoplasm? Maybe I didn't cover that one. I do want to talk about this one. So if you look inside of a cell, inside that cell, it's got living stuff inside the cell. And that's what we call cytoplasm. Cytoplasm is anything inside the cell membrane. And cytoplasm contains these structures that we see. What do we call these structures again? What's a general name for all these structures like mitochondria? Those are organelles. And then there's a fluid part inside the cell. And we call that cytosol. So cytoplasm is equal to two things. Organelles plus cytosol, which is what? The fluid part. That's the watery stuff. Organelles are those structures. That's cytoplasm. It's kind of a nice definition. And nucleoplasm. I just sort of made that word up. But nucleoplasm is what? We'll be talking about that, I'm sure. Nucleoplasm is what? All the living stuff inside the nucleus right here. So there's fluid inside that nucleus, and there's what? There's DNA and RNA inside the nucleus. Those are like the organelles inside the nucleus. Oh, you might have been wondering, how does RNA get out of the nucleus into the cytoplasm? But you see some pores right here? So these nuclear pores, these are holes in the nucleus that allow RNA to leave the nucleoplasm and enter the cytoplasm. Right? Because these membranes are supposed to block chemicals from moving one way or the other. Okay, nuclear pores. Okay, so not anything can move across a plasma membrane. So let's think about how things move across a plasma membrane. All right, let's characterize some of these processes. Well, first off, there are two main ways something can move across a plasma membrane. There are things called passive transport processes. And when we say transport, what do we mean by transport? We're just transporting stuff across the plasma membrane from inside the cell to outside or from outside to inside. So things that will move inside the cell hopefully are the things that the cell needs, not toxic kinds of materials, right? And then moving across the membrane going the other way from inside to outside, maybe that's toxic things that the cell doesn't want anymore or waste products that the cell is getting rid of. Right? So how does a cell do that? One of two general ways, a passive process or an active process. These are both these are transport processes. Passive means that it happens automatically without the expenditure of energy. Right, so passive means does not require energy. Sort of like watching TV. All right, that's passive. An active process, on the other hand, requires energy. What's the form of energy that a cell needs? ATP. It's got to have ATP. So an active transport process requires ATP, and here you can see it right here, ATP. And ATP is broken down into two smaller molecules. That T right there stands for adenosine triphosphate, and tri means, it's a numerical value, means how many? It means three. So there are three phosphates on this adenosine. And when it's broken down, one of the phosphates comes off. We call that inorganic phosphate. So you see a little P sub I that stands for inorganic phosphate. So if the molecule starts with three and it loses one, how many are left? Two. So we call that diphosphate. So in the name, it tells you how many phosphates are left. Diphosphate. Adenosine diphosphate has two phosphates left. And that bond that's holding this phosphate to ADP in ATP contains a lot of energy. And when that bond is broken, that energy is released, and your cell can use it for whatever it wants to use it for. Like to maintain electrical activity in your brain, or building proteins, or moving around, muscle contraction. Or another example would be active transport across the cell membrane. Okay, so the two major kinds of transport across the membrane are either passive or active. So let's talk about passive first. Some examples of passive are diffusion. Let's talk about diffusion for right now. And maybe I should have done this, but I don't have a good perfume bottle. But if I brought a perfume bottle into class and I took the top off, that perfume would evaporate into the air. All right, and even though there's not a fan in here, guess what's going to happen to that perfume molecule that's around the bottle? They're going to move around by what we call diffusion. These perfume molecules are going to move throughout the whole room even though there's nobody fanning them around, and they're going to move from high concentration to low concentration. So near the perfume bottle, that's where there's a high concentration of perfume. And what about way in the back of the room? That's where it's going to be low or even zero, right? Until as soon as I open up the bottle. So these perfume molecules are going to spread out in every direction from high concentration by the bottle to where it's very, very low. And if we close the doors and come back, for instance, like in a week or something, guess what's going to happen? Is there going to be a difference in perfume concentration anywhere in the room? Nope, you know what? After a long time, that perfume is going to fill the room uniformly. So there's no concentration gradient, and then diffusion is going to stop. Perfume won't have a reason to go to one corner or the other because the concentration is going to be the same. All right, something else too. When I first open that perfume bottle, who's going to smell it first? Yeah, I am. Right, exactly right. Then people in the first row and second row, right, then third row, and it's going to spread out through the room. And it's not going to require any energy to do that. It's a passive process. All right, so you got to know passive doesn't require any energy, and things only move from high concentration to low. So, for instance, here we have a nice hill. And when I was in college, maybe you have a car like this. I think I was driving a 1965 MGB. Anybody hear of an MGB? Well, it's a car that was made in England. It was really old. It was about this big. It's a sports car. Okay, had a little engine, and it was always breaking down. And I was in school in Illinois, and the winters are really cold in Illinois. They get below zero, like minus 20 or something. So when the starter motor would burn out on it, you couldn't go out and work on the car because it was just too cold, right? So I'd leave the starter motor in the car, or the battery would go dead, right? You couldn't get the car started when it was really cold. So I learned that, since it was a stick shift, that if I parked on top of a hill like this, so here's my little car, what could I do? I could go to school all day and, you know, study at the library till 11 o'clock at night, but I knew that if I parked on this hill, I could still go home because I would get in the car, put it in first gear, and stick my other leg out the door and give it a little push, and it would start rolling down the hill. Right? And then as it's rolling down the hill, what would I do? Pop the clutch, and I would turn the engine over, and it always worked really nice, so I could go home. All right, so in that particular case, when this car is rolling down the hill, is that active or passive? That's passive. There's no engine on, right? So this is passive. So a passive process means what? High to low. That's a passive process. But in order to get up the hill, what would I need? I need energy, like gasoline. Your cells need, not gasoline, but ATP, right? If you're down over here, to move molecules up from low to high, this is what we call what? Active. Active, meaning that you need ATP. All right, so that's kind of one way to think about active versus passive processes. Passives from high to low. But in terms of concentration, what do we mean? We just mean the number of particles. So let's just put a bunch of particles over here and maybe just a couple over here. Which side of the board has more concentration of particles, on the left or the right? The left is more concentrated than the right. So this is higher concentration, here's lower concentration. Which way are the majority of the particles going to move? Are they going to move to the right or to the left? They're going to go to the right. They're going to go from high concentration to low concentration all by themselves, right? Just because of what we call diffusion. Now, it is possible to get these molecules to all come over here, and there's none over there, but what is that going to require? That's going to require energy. A good example of that is that perfume bottle again. Right, because that perfume bottle has got what? All those perfume molecules in there. Somehow they got in there, but they just wouldn't all go in there by themselves. There has to be some process that took energy to put them all in there. Okay. All right, so that's diffusion. Next term, osmosis. You know what? I bet I got a slide, maybe. Here's a slide. Good luck. Can you see it? Maybe I can describe it to you. Here's a beaker with some water in it. And here's a sugar cube that we just put in the beaker. So there's no sugar anywhere in the water because we just put that sugar cube in there. Well, it's going to dissolve. Here's at a little bit later time. So this is a graph of different beakers versus time. And I can see now that the sugar cube is kind of dissolved away. Can you see the little dots? They're mostly concentrated in this region right here. And if you look up over here, I don't see any dots at all. So there is a concentration gradient. High concentration, low concentration. So by diffusion, these molecules are going to do what? They're going to move out in all these different directions. So here it is, another little bit later time. I can see that they're kind of spread out in this region here, but still hardly any up on top. But if we let this beaker sit there a long time, no matter where we look, we see the same concentration of dots everywhere. Ooh, maybe that would have helped if I would have focused it at the beginning of class. Okay, so here is what? Everything in one area? Here, yeah, high concentration right here, low here. When it dissolves in solution, things are going to spread out. Here you see it spreading, here you see it spreading some more, and after a long time, it's completely uniform. And when everything, when there's no concentration gradient, guess what happens to diffusion? It stops because a gradient is necessary to get things to move around. And when there's no gradient, things have to stop. All right, so that is passive diffusion. Let's talk about osmosis right here. Osmosis is a special kind of diffusion. So is osmosis active or passive? It's passive. For osmosis, how do things move? From high to low or low to high? It's got to be high to low as well. Okay. All right. I need to use another definition for you to see what's going on here. A definition of a solution. A solution has got two parts to it. Anybody know what the two parts of a solution are? A solvent. That's the liquid that you are going to dissolve something in. So a solution is a solvent plus a solute. Pronounced a little funny, a solute. So solvent is the liquid part. And the solute is what? The particle part, the solid part. And if we put those two things together, we get a solution. Who's dealt with a solution today of anything? Anybody deal with a solution of anything today? No? Yeah, what?
Water and ice, drinking Southern.
You're drinking Southern Comfort and water, did you say?
No. That's so it's not today. Just like glass water, like ice and water.
Oh, you had ice water. Okay. I don't know if that's a solution.
Well,
because that's a liquid. You had a little Kool-Aid in there. So you had some sugar, you had some glucose and some color molecules. That's the solute. So if you put Kool-Aid in water, that would be a solution. Okay? So what's a good example of a liquid that could be used to make a solution? Especially in us, it is
what? H2O.
That's a good solvent, right? And the Kool-Aid would be the solute, for instance. But what else did somebody have? How about orange juice? That's a solution, okay? Because it's got the little orange particles in there, and it's got sugars and stuff, and vitamins, right? All right, so what else? Coffee, tea. Those are all solutions. And in us, we're a solution because we're mostly water, but we have, that was maybe even a quiz question. All right, but the solute would be things like sugars and proteins that are dissolved in water. So we're really solutions. We're just kind of baggies with water with some chemicals tossed in it. Okay. All right, so that's a solution. Let's get back to osmosis. So osmosis is a special kind of diffusion. So that means something is going to move from high to low, and it's got three criteria. Osmosis has got three criteria. First, it's got to be diffusion. But now that's kind of a loaded term, because what does diffusion mean to you? High to low? It's passive? I think that's good. All right, that's diffusion. Doesn't require energy. That's the third one. No energy, high to low. No, that's the same thing as passive. Never mind. Okay, diffusion. So osmosis is a special kind of diffusion. And number two, it's not just any kind of molecule. Perfume wouldn't work for osmosis. It doesn't satisfy the definition for osmosis. There's only one molecule in us that will work to be diffusion, and that is the water molecule. So when water diffuses around, that's possibly osmosis. Might not necessarily be, but it's possible. If it's diffusion, that's another criteria. And the third one has got to be the diffusion of water through a membrane, a special kind of membrane, what we call a semi-permeable. Membrane. So if it's all three of those things together, if it's water diffusing, going from high to low, across a semipermeable membrane, then that can be osmosis. That's real important in terms of living systems. I guess I'm going to draw another little picture on the board. So I'll erase this one right here. Okay, so here I have some dots, for instance. And these are water, right? Water is what? The solvent. And here I have some water over here. Just like that. Which way is this water going to go? To the left to right. So water is going to move in this direction like that. But could that be, that's diffusion. Things are moving from high to low. But is that osmosis the way that I have it drawn? What is missing? You don't have a membrane right there, right? So let's draw a membrane in. So here's a membrane, like this. And now water is going to go from this direction to that direction. So this is a trick question. Could this be an example, or is that a good example of osmosis? Well, we've got diffusion, water going from left to right, but that membrane has got to be special. It's got to be what? Semi-permeable. Semi-permeable means that it's going to let some things through, but not others. But the way that I drew it right here, it looks like it's letting everything across. So in order for that to be semi-permeable, let's draw in some other molecules right here. Let's just say this is salt. Which way is salt going to want to go? Right to left or left to right? Left to right, because there's none over here, so there's a big concentration gradient. It's going to be drawn over here, but guess what? When it gets to the membrane, it won't let it through. It can't pass through. So now this membrane right here is selectively permeable. Lets water through, but not salt. So we've got the passive diffusion of water down a concentration gradient, not requiring any energy, through this selectively permeable membrane. Does that qualify for osmosis now? All three of the criteria are met. Okay, so that's what I want you to know about osmosis. Now, why is that important? Well, because we can make different kinds of solutions up. They can be one of these three different kinds of solutions that I have right here. Something called hypotonic, something called isotonic, and something called hypertonic. So let me This is not too bad. Once you take a look at it, here is a nice red blood cell right here. And salt in your body is tightly regulated, and it's pretty much constant. The amount of salt inside of cells is always going to be about 0.9%. And let's just put NaCl right there. And the rest is going to be water. So how much is water inside this cell? If everything is 100% and salt is 0.9, water is going to be 99.1%. So that's not too hard to see that, right? 99.1% H2O. So in cells, what's a major component inside cells? Mostly water, with just a few chemicals in there. Okay. Now let's put this cell in a beaker, and let's just say sodium chloride, the sodium tries to get out, but it can't. But water can. What kind of membrane is that? It's semi-permeable or selectively permeable. And let's put this in a special solution that we mix up, special, so that it is 0.9% NaCl, and that means what? 99.1% water. Where is water concentration higher? Inside the cell or outside the cell?
They're equal.
Okay. So will water want to diffuse? It can. It can get through this membrane, even though it's selectively permeable, but will it move one way or the other? Because there's no concentration gradient, right? So for every water molecule that goes out, one comes in. This cell right here does not change shape. So this is a nice physiologic solution on the outside of the cell that looks like the solution inside the cell. We call that isotonic. That's a nice isotonic solution. Well, let's take a cell. Sorry, I got to erase this over here. Let's take a cell and another beaker. Here's another cell. And so inside that cell, we got what? 0.9% what? Salt? 99.1% H2O. All cells are like that. And we weren't paying attention. We just went down to the ocean and got some salt water, some seawater, and put this cell in there. And so now, instead of 0.9%, let's say it is 3% salt. And how much water is going to be there? 97% water, right? Because that's a 100, H2O. Okay, now where's the water concentration higher, inside the cell or outside the cell? It's higher inside. Will water want to diffuse? Yes, it will want to diffuse. Which way? Out? Yeah, it will want to go from inside the cell to outside the cell. So water is going to want to go out. And indeed it will. This is a selectively permeable membrane. Water is diffusing down its concentration gradient. That fits all the classical definitions or criteria for what term? Osmosis. Now what happens to this cell as water is leaving the cell? Can it keep the same shape?
No.
It's got to shrink. Okay? It's got to shrink. This cell gets smaller. It shrivels up, just like that. And when it shrivels up, we call that process crenation. And the solution that causes crenation is what we call hypertonic. So that's a hypertonic solution. And I just abbreviate solution right there. Hypertonic solution. All right, so we get, so you see my shriveled cell right there? I'm not crossing out the concentrate, it just shriveled up. All right, let's do another beaker. Right over here. So what probably would be good to do? Let's start off with a nice normal cell. What's inside this normal cell? 0.9% NaCl, which is what? Salt. And 99.1% H2O. And again, let's pretend we weren't very careful, and let's put in pure water. 100% water, like right out of the tap. That's almost pure water. Not quite, but really, really close. All right, so, oh, this is 100% what? Water, H2O. Don't forget that sodium chloride tries to get out but can't. So it's a selectively permeable membrane. Which concentration is higher for water, 99.1 or 100? Yeah, 100. Does it look like there's a big difference in water concentration here?
No.
It looks actually pretty small to me in terms of that number. But nonetheless, water will want to do what?
Go
into the cell because it goes from high concentration to low. So water is going to enter the cell. And what's going to happen to that cell? It's going to swell up. As a matter of fact, so much water is going to be sucked inside the cell because of osmosis that it's going to blow the cell up, which is pretty fascinating. We call that, when this cell blows up, it's a red blood cell, blowing something up or digesting something is called lysis. When we blow that cell up, it's called hemolysis. The cell is going to hemolyze. The process is hemolysis. And the kind of solution that causes hemolysis is what we call hypotonic. That's a hypotonic solution. Okay, so that's why it's really important to know something about the selectively permeable membrane and osmosis, because sometimes patients need fluids. Maybe some of you have needed a fluid, maybe a transfusion or something at some point in time. What kind of solution would you like to be transfused with? A hypertonic solution, or a hypotonic solution, or an isotonic solution? Isotonic, because an isotonic solution is the only kind of solution that's going to maintain your cells in a healthy state. Other solutions are going to shrink them down. Other kinds of solutions are going to, what? Blow them up. That's terrible. Okay? All right, so knowing these different solutions is very important. This one right here, if we shrivel a cell up, or if we crenate it, we take a crenated cell and put it in an isotonic solution, guess what? It's going to go back to its normal shape. That's okay. All right, so that's maybe not so bad, but I tell you what, if you take the cell here and hemolyze it, can you ever get it back to look like this one? No, you can't. Say if you have a balloon, right, and you let all the air out, you crenate it, you can still do what? You can still inflate it to look like a normal balloon again. But if you have a balloon and you pop it, you hemolyze it, you can never make it into a balloon again, right? So this process of hemolysis is what we call irreversible. That cell is gone forever. Crenation is reversible. But either one could kill somebody, because even a crenated cell won't carry oxygen in your blood quite right. All right, so how can you remember on the test what solution causes what? Even if I don't give this lecture for 20 years, I would be able to memorize that. Actually, I don't have to memorize it. There's a little trick I use. Your brain might not work like mine, but it maybe is kind of helpful. Do you want to hear how I do it? Or I mean, it's really, it's kind of... kind of stupid, but if you want to know, I'll tell you, because it might help you out. Okay? All right, so there is an E in crenation right here, and there's an E in hypertonic. There is an O in hemolysis, and there's an O in hypotonic. So you'll be able to memorize that at least for a couple weeks until the test, right? Because those could be questions on the test, right? But you should also be aware of the physiology that's taking place there as well. All right, so when we come back, I think we have a quiz next time on the student study guide, just like before. Oh, I got to pass some quizzes back. So if you want to stick around for quizzes, that's fine. We're going to start right here again. And we're going to start when? September 4th. Okay. So start studying that chapter. Make sure you come back with some questions or something for me. Because I don't know if you thought about this kind of stuff before. But it's not too terribly difficult, I don't think. Okay.
I'll pass back some quizzes.